This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to Audio Journal's reading of Yankee Magazine. You'll hear stories about the people and places that make New England special. Mountains, farmland, salty seacoasts, history, sports teams, universities, cultural attractions, and more. This is Naomi. I'll be reading from the July-August issue of Yankee Magazine. Thank you for joining me. I'll begin by reading the table of contents. The features this month are Tidal Bout. It's North versus South as two Massachusetts travel writers make the case for which of their state's famous shores reign supreme, by Diane Blair and Pamela Wright. Residential Power. New England's presidential homes offer rare insight into their former occupants and the real human foundations that shaped their time in office, by Justin Shatwell. Page 76, Conversations, Ethan Tepper. On doing the hard and sometimes heartbreaking work of keeping our forests healthy. Interview by Rowan Jacobson. Page 80, Temples of Unhurried Delight. From antiques-filled cottages to quaint rustic cabins, author and design journalist J.C. Conries' new book invites us into the iconic summer house, by Madeline Billis. Page 88, Goodbye to a Grand Laker. It's hard letting go of an old boat, let alone a piece of Maine's legendary sporting heritage, by Wayne Curtis. In the home section, page 24, Three's Company, sizing up the lore and legacy of New England's iconic urban housing, The Triple Decker, by Bruce Irving. Page 30, Made in New England, with do-it-yourself grit and a splash of locally sourced seawater, Atlantic Soap Company is turning out sudsy works of art, by Courtney Hollins. In the food section, page 36, Main Courses, and that is spelled M-A-I-N-E. The debut cookbook from acclaimed New England chef Devin Finnegan aims to give readers a deeper taste of land and sea. Page 42, Weekends in the Kitchen. Nothing beats the sweet tart delight of summer tomatoes, celebrated here in two easy recipes inspired by our TV show, by Amy Traverso. In the travel section, page 44, Weekend Away. The big beach is only the start of the summer experience in Agonquit, Maine, by Ian Aldrich. Page 52, How to Staycation. These quick-hit New England destinations prove you don't have to drive for days to make great vacation memories, by Bill Scheller. And in the departments, on page 10 is behind the scenes. Page 12, first person, learning to see a full spectrum of history in a can of humble white paint, by Howard Mansfield. Page 16, first light, a historic steam locomotive and riverboat combine for a one-of-a-kind experience in the Lower Connecticut River Valley, by Ryan Cashman. Page 22, Up Close. 25 years after nearly going dark, a Lake Winnipesaukee icon shines on, by Benjamin Cassidy. And page 112, Here in New England, our most powerful connections to the past aren't always found in museums, by Mel Allen. On the cover of this issue of Yankee, is the Scituate Lighthouse in Scituate, Massachusetts. And that photo is by Adam D. Tor. I'll begin by reading the column Inside Yankee Behind the Scenes, a birthday invitation by the senior managing editor, Jen Johnson. Back in 1976, as America's bicentennial fever was hitting its peak, Eric Sloan seemed to have reasons for feeling a bit pessimistic. In an essay published in Yankee's July issue that year, the Connecticut artist and author of such books as Diary of an Early American Boy wrote that if the founding fathers could have witnessed Watergate, Vietnam, and the assorted social ills of the day, they would have again dedicated their lives to a revolution. But in the same essay, Sloan reminds us that unlike birthdays along a human lifespan, every year that our country ages shows how America has the sweet secret and habit of renewal. Compared with Yankee's July 1976 issue, whose cover featured a steely-eyed bald eagle and the words America and her New England, 200 years and on course, the issue you hold in your hands won't look as if it had much to do with the nation's latest birthday, its 250th. We didn't compile the be-all, end-all guide to visiting New England's historical sites, though you will find a thoughtful look at places that U.S. presidents once called home on page 70. We don't offer recipes for the ultimate red, white, and blue cookout. Instead, Chef Devin Finnegar shares dishes that speak to love of home, in her case, the Maine coast, on page 36. You won't read profiles of soldiers and politicians who rose up from these six states to change the world, but rather you'll meet a Vermont forester on a mission to tend to the land that's right in front of him, on page 76. No, this is a Yankee issue like any other. It celebrates what we cherish about New England, big things and small, old ways and new ideas, and most important, it invites everyone to come share in it too. Come mingle with people from around the world on beautiful beaches like those on Massachusetts' Twin Shores, page 56. Stroll our cities and see reminders of the generations of working families who helped make them great, on page 24. Because in New England and in the nation, connecting to both history and people matters. That is the true sweet secret of renewal. The contributors to the magazine this month are Adam Detour, a highlight of photographing title bout on page 56, says Detour, was hiking through the dunes at Crane Beach on Massachusetts' North Shore. Despite being so close to Boston, the landscape feels completely secluded and untouched, says the Boston-based freelancer, whose work has appeared in such publications as the New York Times Magazine, the Boston Globe, and Edible Boston. The next contributor is Courtney Hollins. To get a feel for what goes into Caroline Lay's sculptural soaps in the article Bathing Beauties on page 30, Hollins spent a day shadowing the Atlantic Soap Company founder. It was fascinating to see her process up close, says Hollins, a writer and editor whose resume includes stints at Culture, Boston Magazine, and Tufts Magazine. She approaches each bar with care and a true artist's eye. John S. Dykes, the illustrator for our story on presidential homes on page 70, has always been interested in revisiting historical figures and putting them into new and sometimes unexpected settings. Something even more intriguing in context of America's 250th, he says. Dyke's artwork can be found at the Norman Rockwell Museum and the New Britain Museum of American Art and in many private collections. And the final contributor is Rowan Jacobson, an award-winning journalist who lives in rural Vermont. Jacobson writes about science and nature, making him a perfect fit for interviewing forester and author Ethan Tapper on page 76 about the hard work of caring for our natural resources. Jacobson's latest book, In Defense of Sunlight, The Surprising Science of Sun Exposure, is due out from Scribner in July. I'm now going to read a feature article called Presidential Power. New England's presidential homes offer rare insight into their famous former occupants and the real human foundations that shaped their time in office. By Justin Shatwell. From the top of Penn's Hill, the British troops are barely visible. It's June 17, 1775, and Abigail Adams has climbed the summit near her home in what is now Quincy, Massachusetts, to glimpse the Battle of Bunker Hill unfolding 10 miles to the north. Sounds of the battle ripple across the open farmland and beat against the walls of Abigail's home. That evening, she writes to her husband, John, the future second president of the United States. The constant roar of the cannon is so distressing that we cannot eat, drink, or sleep. Since that fateful moment 251 years ago, countless Americans have lived their lives in the communities around Boston. The quiet farmland that Abigail gazed across has since yielded a crop of family homes, shopping plazas, universities, and highways. Today, it's hard to imagine someone in Quincy seeing or hearing anything on Bunker Hill, the urban maze around Boston having grown so thick. But still, this sea of modernity occasionally parts on a small island of the past, a fleeting glimpse of what the country looked like all those years ago. Abigail and John Adams' homestead is just such an island. It sits on a small triangular lot in Quincy where two roads meet at a sharp angle. It's exactly the type of parcel that would hold a gas station if only two presidents had not been born here. The homestead consists of two modest salt box houses. John Adams was born in one, his son John Quincy Adams in the other. They're in excellent condition, in part due to the efforts of Matthew Vigno, the curator of the Adams National Historical Park. He explains that he rarely gives tours. His job is to ensure that things don't fall apart. Preserve the homes, preserve the objects, preserve the landscape, he says. The last task is perhaps the most challenging. For anyone standing on the lawn, there is nothing in sight to suggest this once was an apple orchard. Traffic streams past both sides of the parcel, just feet from the homestead. The view from Abigail and John Adams' back door is a funeral home across the street. The front window looks out on a dentist's office. How do you make someone feel like they're on a farm? Vigno asks, gesturing at the scene. You're hearing the roads, you're hearing the trains. It's the question the park asked with increasing urgency as it entered 2026. It's the nation's 250th anniversary, and there are to be sure to be more visitors as Americans reconnect with their roots at places like this. For many, their visit will be the first time they really get to know the two Adamses. The public memory of these men is hazy at best. John Adams was a thinker and orator, not a soldier. He didn't serve in the army like Washington or Hamilton. Instead, he fought his battles on the floor of the Continental Congress and as a diplomat abroad. When he became president, he was the first pure politician to hold the office, and people loved him accordingly. He was ousted after 4 years. His term was dominated by efforts to keep America from being sucked into the Napoleonic Wars. John Quincy Adams' career followed a similar trajectory. He earned his reputation as a senator and diplomat before becoming the 6th United States president. He focused on improving the young nation's infrastructure, but much of his agenda died in congressional gridlock. Like his father, he also got one term. Neither man received a monument in Washington, D.C., or got his portrait on major currency. These little homes in Massachusetts, lovingly preserved, may be the best testaments we have to them. Inside the first Adams birthplace is plainly furnished. There is little on the walls and just a few pieces of furniture. A large hearth dominates the front room. Vigno talks quickly. He knows the history of the property backwards and forward, but he's most passionate when talking about the place itself. He raves about the health of the clapboards and vents about his hatred of silverfish. He talks about the buildings like they're living things and would love to see them breathe again as they did when people lived and worked here. These houses are supposed to be open, every window, every door open. That hearth running, just air movement, he says. Vigno stops in his tracks. Some blemish on a ceiling beam has caught his eye. He probes it with his finger like a moment, and we continue. We watch these things like hawks, he says. We're in every one of these buildings 7 days a week, year-round, too. It strikes me that there is something monastic about Vigno, not in his temperament, but in his devotion. It's clear that part of his mind is always cloistered here. In the John Quincy Adams house, Vigno invites me to poke my head into the attic. It's dark and empty, but this is a place to be felt, not seen. The sounds of the road are muffled here. The dome of heat at the top of the house makes the air warm and almost sticky. And in that air, there is a perfume of ancient timber and dust that overwhelms me. This space has existed longer than our country, and the air here has aged like wine in a barrel. It's like smelling the past. Unmistakable, Vigno says of the scent, and I nod. He wishes he could let guests up here to experience it too. You could go on tour here and remember nothing, but if I put this smell in front of you, you'd know it, he says. It's the sensory aspect of what I think resonates more. It's the power of place. Back on the lawn, we have to talk loudly to hear each other. As much as he struggles with the growth of Quincy, Vigno himself is a product of it. He grew up around here. He and the Adamses were born just miles apart. The stone wall running along the edge of the property was his mother's bus stop when she was a girl. He got a picture of it framed for her. That's how I connected. I am here, he says. We discuss the park's plans. They're improving the walkways and planting some trees to screen the view. A small grove of apples will be a nod to the old orchard. It won't transport the homestead back in time. The town will still be here, but I'm not sure that's a bad thing. There's value in this tension between an ever-changing world and a parcel stuck in time. It's like seeing both ends of the rainbow, where it all started and where we've all come. The homesteads, the funeral parlor, the traffic, what we've torn down and what we work tirelessly to save is all part of the same unfolding story. A world away in the pine forests of southern New Hampshire, another New England president's home sits by the side of the road. Far fewer cars pass here. Standing by the stone wall at the front of the parking area, I'm greeted not by the roar of traffic, but by a chorus of chipmunks hidden among the stones. Where the public memory of the Adamses is hazy, that of Franklin Pierce is almost extinguished. New Hampshire's only president was the 14th person to hold the job and consistently ranked among the worst. To be fair, he was dealt a terrible hand. He was inaugurated in 1853, when the fissure between abolition and slavery ran through every American institution, including Pierce's own Democratic Party. His name was floated as a compromise candidate at a divided convention. He didn't particularly want the job and was dumbstruck to learn he had gotten it. Pierce's mandate was clear. His policies were expected to thread a needle that could keep his coalition stitched together. Unsurprisingly, he failed. Americans craved a reckoning on slavery, not more compromise. His generous concessions to a slaveholding states alienated his northern supporters. After 4 years, the nation was closer to rupture, and the Democratic Party was in shambles. Delegates at the next convention refused to renominate Pierce, making him the first elected president to be effectively fired by his own party. His only consolation is that James Buchanan, his replacement, is the only president regularly ranked lower than him. Pierce's home in Hillsboro is the type you might see in any New England town of a certain age, stately but unremarkable. Its flat facade faces the road, with two symmetrical rows of windows framing a heavy wooden door at the center. Additions ramble off the back like a tail. A large livestock barn attached to the house serves as the visitor center. This site is state-run, so the displays are humble. No polished orientation film greets visitors, just a few framed photos and text panels. What we lack in amenities, we have to make up for in content, quips Sarah Dobrowolski, the homestead's manager. As she gives tours, Dobrowolski seems as stately as the home. The daughter of an army chaplain, she exudes a kind of disciplined compassion. She sticks to the facts, but it's clear she's developed feelings for the family whose story she tells. Her tour begins not with Franklin, but with his father, Benjamin, who built the house. A Revolutionary War veteran with grand ambitions, he bought this plot because it sat at a crossroads. This was a particularly busy road, she says, referencing the now sleepy lane out front that extends in the direction of the state capital, Concord. There would be nonstop ox carts and mules hauling wagons back and forth out there. At several points during her tour, Dobrowolski gestures out a window and asks visitors to imagine a scene that isn't there. Unlike at the Adams property, where guests are told to imagine there is less, Dobrowolski urges them to envision more. More buildings, more bustle, more noise, and more people. Especially more people. Benjamin was never happy until this place was crammed full, Dobrowolski says. He designed the house with the intention of opening it to the world. The back rooms were reserved for his wife and 9 children. The front rooms he ran as a tavern and, for a short time, an inn. There was space for men to drink and a well-appointed drawing room for ladies. The second floor was built as an open ballroom with sprung floors so you could hold a town dance without shaking the plaster off the ceiling below. Benjamin was a jovial backslapper who could make friends with everyone. Once the inn was established, he started dabbling in politics, and his charms eventually lifted him to the governorship. Franklin was the child most like his father, and Benjamin paved the way for his son's success. Franklin received an education and became a lawyer. A meteoric rise through state politics led to stints in the House of Representatives and the Senate. When he ultimately became president, he was the youngest person to be elected at just 48. As Dobrowolski continues her tour through the narrow hallways, it's clear she is more enamored with this house than the White House. Pierce's presidency is mentioned, of course, but most of her stories are about little domestic events. She talks about how Franklin's mother, Anna, discouraged the use of the front door so that dust, dirt, and noise from the road wouldn't flood in. Or how after a stroke curbed Benjamin socializing, he tried his hand at knitting. And she explains how a young, handsome Franklin Pierce shocked the town by marrying a shy and sickly woman because, in his words, no one could have taken better care of her than him. These are details she's gleaned from reading countless letters and diaries. She talks enthusiastically about all the research she has done and all the research she wishes yet to do. Franklin Pierce is not widely studied, so she's sure there are letters buried in dusty collections somewhere, hiding more clues about who he really was. Every time I catch something like that, it adds another piece to the puzzle, and I can see this whole picture of a family, Dobrowolski says. Sometimes people complain about Dobrowolski's tour because she doesn't focus on politics. That's not what this is about, she says. She doesn't want to dwell on things people could just as easily read in a book. Some stories only a house can tell. I'm talking about the family because I want you to understand the man and where he came from and why he behaved the way he did and what he was really like as a person, she says. There's wisdom in Dobrowolski's approach. It's easy to forget that presidents are just people, flawed individuals who lived and learned and loved in some house by a road. Driving home, I pass hundreds of houses. Inside, thousands of lives are playing out. Who's to say where they will lead? Any house could one day have a plaque out front and tour guide inside piecing together the puzzle of the person who got their start there. The next article is from the travel section, Weekend Away, Ogunquit, Maine. The big beach is only part of the summer experience at this seaside gem by Ian Aldrich. It was only the start of summer, but an old-fashioned heat wave had already descended on the land. Across New England, temperatures were nudging close to triple digits. If you weren't near the water, you were desperate to get there. And by sheer luck, a planned trip had put my teenage son and me on Maine's Ogunquit River for an early morning stand-up paddle. For a good hour, we meandered under a bridge past fellow vacationers on land lumbering toward the beach, alongside breezy tidal flats. We weren't the only ones there, but at times it sure felt that way. Incredibly, everything would soon change. To know the Ogunquit River is to know its two dispositions. Twice a day, this nearly 10-mile ribbon of water, which runs from inland South Berwick to the Atlantic in its namesake town, empties out at low tide, revealing a band of beautiful mudflats that become their own kind of playground. But time it right on a prime summer day as the water rises again, and you will be drenched in the most summery of scenes. Boogie boarders, tubers, and rafters riding this lazy river to the very same slice of ocean that once inspired a roving band of early 20th century artists, from Edward Hopper to George Bellows. Ogunquit Beach stretches a dazzling 3.5 miles from the center of town all the way to the more remote sections of Footbridge and North Beaches. In a state where much of the coastline is in private hands, Ogunquit proudly hangs its welcome sign. 100% of its beachfront is open to the public. Yet it's what you'll find just beyond the surf that lends real summer flair to this town, where Maine's top restaurants share the same zip code as wooden seafood shacks. It's home to one of the finest seaside strolls in New England, arguably one of the most beautifully sited museums in the country, and a beloved summer stock theater that puts Broadway veterans on the stage many nights of the season. It was clearly evening when we first arrived on the coast, just in time to fit in a leisurely dinner at Walker's Maine, Cape Natick, the creation of veteran Maine restaurateurs Justin and Danielle Walker. The restaurant has an informal air. Couch and chairs anchored in front of the fieldstone fireplace are a popular nightcap spot. With an ambitious menu flavored by herbs and veggies grown at Danielle's nearby family farm. From the kitchen's wood-fired hearth, meanwhile, Justin churns out a rotation of specialties. We feasted on roasted carrots, haddock, and chicken, mopping up every last bit before hurrying to make the short drive to the Ogunquit Playhouse, where we cooled off with fresh-pressed lemonade and a sold-out performance of Guys and Dolls. We were still humming a few show tunes as we dropped anchor at the Dunes on the waterfront, a 12-acre compound of 22 guest cottages on the banks of the Ogunquit River. Opened in 1936, the property retains a kind of unassuming charm, even after new owners put $10 million into upgrades just 2 years ago. The resulting ship-shaped cottages sit against a beautifully landscaped property featuring a pool, a fire pit, and a wide lawn that runs to the river's bluffs. Guest amenities run the gamut from free bikes to a pontoon boat, beach service, to a daily morning delivery of hot coffee. the New York Times, and fresh pastries from nearby Bread and Roses Bakery. The next day, we just barely managed to snag a table at the popular Greenery Cafe, where co-owner Amy Hale presides over a fortifying menu that includes Maine-centric crab cake Benedict and a lobster brie omelet. This place had closed, and I kept saying, somebody should do something with it, says Hale, a Massachusetts native who moved to Ogunquit a decade ago after years of summer vacationing in the area. That someone became me. She threw up her arms triumphantly. 10 years later, here we are. It was still a few hours from peak heat when we shuffled over to the Marginal Way, a 1.25 mile long cliff walk that opens up to some of the most spectacular views of Maine's southern waters. Up and down you go along a paved path that caters to walking and sitting. A scattering of benches is found along the way, all suitably facing the ocean horizon. With the sun now at its high point, we decided to drop into the air-conditioned Ogunquit Museum of American Art, a mid-century-style building perched atop Narrow Cove. Its permanent collection of more than 3,000 photographs, paintings, drawings, and sculptures spans the late 1800s to the present and is studded with marquee names such as Marsden Hartley and Elliot O'Hara. But the jaw-dropping permanent exhibit here just might be the ocean views that pour in from the museum's large back windows. The next morning, we recarbed with a couple of croissants and a Nutella latte from Mornings in Paris, a French-inspired downtown cafe, before heading to Perkins Cove, a historic fishing harbor nested at the southern tip of Ogunquit. It was peak vacation land vibe. Tourists filled the tiny village center, while pretty boats dotted the water. We eventually found ourselves at a coveted outside table at Barnacle Billy's, an icon of the local seafood scene that first opened in 1961. For many years, it was a favorite lunch spot for President George H.W. Bush, who often arrived by boat from his home in Kennebunkport. His meal of choice was reportedly the grilled hot dog. But if only the late commander-in-chief knew what he was missing. My son let out an audible wow when our server delivered a pair of monster lobster rolls. If we'd been up for the challenge, we could have caught our own crustaceans with the help of an actual lobster man, just a few doors down with finest kind scenic cruises. Instead, we opted for the Outfitters' equally popular tour, a 90-minute ride to Nubble Light and back. To reverse engineer sightseeing and take in the Maine coastline from the water is to appreciate its enduring beauty. We motored past what the locals call Pirate's Cove, home to a legendary loot of buried treasure, and past miles of ancient rocks and jagged cliffs, before taking a spin around one of the world's most famous lighthouses. Like millions of others, I've seen the Nubble from the vantage point of Sohier Park in York. But this was my first experience viewing it by boat. Back at the dunes that evening, my son and I flopped down into chairs overlooking the river for one last moment of the day. Waves crashed and retreated in the distance, while a now delightful heat still clung to the evening air. We fell quiet for a few minutes as we nursed a few cold drinks. I couldn't have conjured up a better start to the summer season. Exploring Ogunquit, Maine, eat and drink. Barnacle Billy's, the restaurant's claw meat packed lobster roll is literally the stuff of legend. And whether you're dining at Billy's original 1961 location or at its neighboring sister restaurant, any wait is always worth it. Big Daddy's homemade ice cream. Nearly 50 flavors in all highlight the big board at this beloved sweet shop, including Maine blueberry pie, as well as a tasty selection of frops, sundaes, and ice cream sodas. Cornerstone Pizza. Maine-made beers and an expansive pizza menu that includes, wait for it, lobster are the stars of this popular downtown spot. The Greenery Cafe. Locals and tourists alike converge at this breakfast joint, which opens at 7 a.m. and offers a menu of inventive bennies as well as an assortment of made-from-scratch muffins, scones, and cupcakes. Jonathan's. 50 years ago this summer, Jonathan West turned his childhood home into an Algonquin original, an upscale restaurant on the first floor and a second floor performance venue that has welcomed acts like the Indigo Girls and Lenny Clark. Mornings in Paris, sweet and savory crepes, not to mention an assortment of croissants and various caffeinated pick-me-ups, highlight the menu. Walker's Maine Cape Nettic. Since opening in 2018, this restaurant has rightfully piled up a number of accolades, including 4-diamond status from AAA. Upscale but never pretentious, Walker serves up a revolving mix of hearty dishes from duck to ribs to salmon that are cooked over Chef Justin Walker's big kitchen hearth. Where to stay? The Beachmere Inn, conveniently located on the marginal way, this classic resort hotel caters to guests with in-room fireplaces, access to a hot tub, and an on-site spa and fitness center. The Dunes on the waterfront, Algonquin's only on-the-river cottage-style lodging. The Dunes offer easy access to the water and plenty of family touches that will keep everyone in your crowd happy. Where to play? Finest Kind Scenic Cruises. 70 years after sixth-generation Mainer Oscar Hubbard first welcomed guests aboard his cruiser, Finest Kind offers a range of tours, including a scenic breakfast option and an evening cocktail route. Marginal Way. While hardly a strenuous hike, this 1.25-mile jaunt remains one of the most popular in New England. The trail features a number of access points, but if you want to walk it from end to end, we recommend starting from Perkins Cove and strolling north to Shore Road, then jogging onto Wharf Lane and over to Algonquin Beach. Algonquin Museum of American Art. Big ocean views and peaceful gardens add to the visual experience at this museum, the only one in Maine dedicated exclusively to American art. Perkins Cove Bookshop. A grand beach deserves a grand beach read, and Algonquin's only dedicated bookshop stocks approximately 2,500 titles, including a robust selection from Maine authors. Wheels and Waves Wells. Ditch the car and power your own sightseeing tour. The shop includes e-bike rentals as well as surf and paddleboard lessons. Our next article is from the food section, and it's a recipe spotlight. The title of the article is Maine Courses. A new cookbook from acclaimed New England chef Devin Finnegan gives readers a deeper taste of land and sea. Augusta, began its life as a Harborview restaurant in the fishing village of Stonington, where Maine's largest lobster catch is still hauled in every season. Aragosta means lobster in Italian. 6 years later, riding on a wave of critical praise, it moved to its current home on Deer Isle's Goose Cove. A stunning sweep of bay and in islands, spruce trees, and granite ledges, where chef owner Devin Finnegan could welcome her growing audience into a larger dining room with outdoor decks, guest cottages, and a glass greenhouse turned dining room. Through all her years of cooking and through off-season internships at restaurants in Italy and Spain, at Per Se and Blue Hill at Stone Barns, Finnegan kept up an internal monologue, notes for the book she would one day write about everything she was learning. "It's been living in my head for years," she says, "not as a someday project, but as something I've been quietly building with every season that passes. After years of thinking of being asked, 'When are you going to write a cookbook?' she finally got to writing it all down. It's fitting that A Kitchen on Goose Cove, Recipes from the Heart of Maine, should be so deeply rooted in this place she calls home. In Maine, you do not cook the same way year-round," she says. "The ingredients don't let you. This book's 75 recipes are designed to let those ingredients shine. Blueberry pavlova, sweet corn chowder, grilled swordfish steaks with summer salsa." Her goal? To teach readers to cook with confidence. "I want readers to feel that Maine seasonal cooking is something they can actually own," she says. "Not special occasion cooking, just cooking with clarity and intention, guided by what is fresh. I've watched friends and guests light up when they realize lobster does not need to be intimidating, or that mussels can be a weeknight dinner, or that the best meals are often the simplest ones when the ingredients are real." Meanwhile, the restaurant continues to grow beyond the kitchen and dining room. This summer, Finnegan plans to offer guests deeper experiences of Goose Cove, yoga on the beach, guided kayak tours, a new champagne-themed beach bar, salt air, great bottles, and food that tastes like exactly where you are, she says. Finnegan hopes the following recipes, all excerpted from A Kitchen on Goose Cove, remind readers that Maine is not one flavor. "It's a coastline, a working culture, and a rhythm," she says. "Lobster, oysters, local fish, yes, but also the farms, the people who pull food from the sea and the soil, and the way the seasons shape everything. If someone finishes the book feeling inspired to cook Maine cuisine and feeling connected to where it comes from, then it's doing what I wrote it to do." One of the recipes listed here is for haddock fillets with Deer Isle succotash. Finnegan writes, "Succotash is an ancient recipe made long before Europeans first came to New England. I make mine with string beans because when the other vegetables in this recipe are at their peak, so are string beans. You can serve succotash, as we do here, with a simple baked haddock for a fresh and light summer meal." If you'd like to get the recipes, please contact the audio journal and they'll be happy to provide the recipes for you. The second recipe that she offers is sweet corn vegetarian chowder. Chowder is as New England as a soup can be. It's usually made with clams, lobster, or fin fish, but this vegetarian version is quite hearty and stick to your ribs. It hits the spot when served up warm on a rainy day. Try it chilled the next day, just like cold leek and potato soup. Rain or shine, it makes for a lovely lunch served with a green salad and a piece of crusty bread. The next recipe is for little necks in smoky spice tomato sauce with linguine. For summer vacation, when I was a kid, we'd pile in the car and drive to Ogunquit, Maine, and camp out in tents. One of our favorite group projects was to scramble around for clams at low tide, feeling for them with our toes in the mud. Those summers began my love affair with Maine. Over Christmas and New Year's, when we were back home in Vermont, we didn't have much fresh seafood, so our version of the traditional Feast of the Seven Fishes on Christmas Eve included the only fresh sea creatures we could find in the market, clams. Every year, my dad would make linguine and clams in spicy tomato sauce. This updated version of his recipe gets some Middle Eastern smoke, spice, and tanginess from barissa and preserved lemon. If you keep these two condiments on hand, you will never run out of ways to use them. Harissa has a spicy kick, so adjust it to taste. And the final recipe that she talks about is blueberry fool pavlova. This pavlova checks all the boxes that I want in a dessert. Crispiness from the light as air meringue, creaminess from the whipped cream, and sweetness from the blueberry puree. Lightly mixing whipped cream and puree so that veins of blue run through the white cream makes it what the British call a fool. You'll top it with the sweet pop and light tang of fresh blueberries, ideally just picked from a Maine blueberry baron. Our next article is from the First Light section, Up Close. Glowing Strong, Weir's Beach. 25 years after nearly going dark, a Lake Winnipesaukee landmark shines on. Along the zigzagging shores of Lake Winnipesaukee in Laconia, New Hampshire, a mid-century marvel points back in time. The Weir's Beach sign, with its classic neon lettering and flashing arrow, has directed travelers to a boardwalk brimming with activity since 1956. In the 70 years since, the sign has become a totem, not just of the state's largest lake, but of the region's vintage summer revelry. Before the 1950s, locals called this stretch of lakefront Weirs, or more often, the Weirs, in reference to the fishing trap Native Americans used in the channel. But in 1955, 5 years after the dredging of this waterway helped to create a large sandy wedge, the Laconia City Council voted unanimously to change the name to Weir's Beach. The local railroad station, which helped usher in the area's tourism boom during the 19th century, switched the name of its stop accordingly. And a group of local business owners scrunched together $2,200 to erect their own monument to this newly branded summer resort. On July 19, 1956, framed by a truck and crane, many of these local figures posed for a photo alongside the soon-to-be-erected Weir's Beach Arrow sign. They beamed beneath the distinctive neon letters and yellow-coated bulbs that were designed to flash sequentially along the curved arrow. In total, the new marker weighed in at an impressive 4,400 pounds. Actress and singer Marilyn Maxwell had her picture taken in front of it the following year. But more than a few times in this ensuing decades, the sign's signature lights went dark, and repairs were costly. By the turn of the century, Laconia officials weighed replacing this structure altogether. Instead, they opted to restore the sign in 2002 at the urging of locals. Resident Allison Hildebrand had gathered more than 2,000 signatures on a petition to refurbish the 12-foot landmark. Today, after additional maintenance efforts overseen by the Weirs Action Committee, 696 LED bulbs flash around 200 feet of neon lettering. They light up now more than ever. Once solely a sign of summer, the letters and arrow now glow throughout the year. And in homes around the country, images of the Weirs Beach sign adore coffee mugs, totes, and ornaments. This summer, the committee will hold a celebration to commemorate the sign's septuagenarian status. One thing's for sure, they won't have to worry about lightning. This reading of Yankee Magazine has been a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program, please schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Naomi. Thank you for listening.
This is Bird Noir. I'm Private Eye Michael Stein. Every good investigator knows to stay vigilant for suspicious behavior. But a call from my old friend Cora reminded me that there's often more to a bird than meets the eye.
Michael, I just found the strangest bird. He looked like a crow, but sounded all wrong.
That does seem odd, Cora. Could he be a common raven? They look like giant crows that sound deep and croaky.
No, his calls were more short and nasal. I even said to him, "What, you got a cold or something?" And that bird called back to me saying, "Uh-uh." I mean, the whole thing seems fishy to me.
Fishy is right, but not for the reason you think. In most of the U.S., the American crow is the only crow in town. That's the caw you're probably used to. But on the Atlantic coast, and parts of the Midwest too, the fish crow is a common city bird. The two species look the same, but the fish crow's nasal caw is unmistakable.
Huh? I had no idea there were two kinds of crows.
Actually, there are more than 30 species worldwide.
Okay, wise guy. I'll drop you a line if any of them come cawing.
Yep, another case closed. For Bird Noir, I'm Private Eye Michael Stein.